Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. Welcome once again to Tuesday Talk with Key West Lou. I am your host, Louis Patron. This has been another bang-up week. So many things are happening nationally, internationally, that there isn't time to discuss them all in one show, no matter how long your show is. And these are hectic things that are occurring. Some of them are very dangerous, cause concern. I want to start with a happy occasion I had last night. I had the pleasure of hearing Lou Harris speak. Lou Harris, for those of you who might not be aware of him, he is considered the Dean of American Pollsters. All right. He was one of the first ones. He did the first poll for a presidential election. John Kennedy asked him in 1960 to do his polls. And he was the leader in that field of polling political events. At the same time, so you can appreciate the quality of this man and the things he accomplished, in 1962, you know how we watch TV the night of an election, and they tell you, we will shortly tell you who the winner is. We can't project yet. We don't know, or we can project immediately. Sometimes when the polls close, they know who the winner is. Lou Harris designed the program whereby this could be done using certain data and computers. And it's still used today with a few modifications. He was and is the man in that regard. I listened to him speak last night at St. Paul's Church here in Key West. We have many people over the years that have lived here, that have been involved in various aspects. It isn't just Ernest Hemingway and a Tennessee Williams and a John Hersey. People like Lou Harris, too, who come here and they settle down. They retire here. Lou Harris is 94 years old. Sharp mind. The body may be a little weak. Sharp mind, though, was able to handle questions, and he hit the bullseye every time, I thought. He knew presidents intimately, as he put it. First president he knew very well was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Knew the man extremely well, obviously a great president. John Kennedy. He said John Kennedy would have been one of our great presidents were it not for his assassination. He knew Joseph Kennedy intimately, Joseph Kennedy being John Kennedy's father, and that was a man to know back then because he had been, prior to World War II, he had been United States ambassador to Great Britain. They say he was a bootlegger in his earlier days. He was prior to the Irish Mafia, which would have fit in that time frame back then, and then he turned out to be the great man who produced a son as president, two sons who were war heroes, a son as United States Senator Robert Kennedy, and so forth. And he spoke very well and quite a while about Lyndon Johnson. He considered Lyndon Johnson one of our great presidents, passed a lot of good legislation, knew how to get things done, though, because he had been in the Congress of the United States. He had served in the Senate, was majority leader of the Senate. He knew how to twist arms. If he needed a vote, he'd call that senator or congressman and say, look, I want your vote. You don't give me the vote, you don't get the new dam that we're giving you money for to start building next year. That simple. He knew how to twist arms and get the job done. He thought that he dislikes present-day pollsters. Not all of them, but most of them. Because they don't go out, he said, to do an independent job. They do not make an independent observation and return to their customer or their client with the truth. He says the pollsters of today give their customer, give their client what they want to hear. In other words, you pay me and I'll tell you exactly what you want to hear. I'll make the numbers work so it looks like your guy is winning. And he said the proof of the pudding, and this is very true, think of it, was Romney. Romney got BS'd all the way down the line. His pollsters all had him way ahead. He was going to be the next president. And look what happened to him. He thinks Hillary Clinton will be the next president. He thinks she'll make a good president. She's got one problem, though, in getting the presidency, and that's this email thing that's come up. That could develop, he said, into something very burdensome, which could prevent her from even getting the nomination. But right now he sees her as the next president of the United States. The Republicans have killed themselves for I don't know how many years, he said, because of the way they've handled things in the last 6 years. Elizabeth Warren, he thought that the senator from Massachusetts was more exciting than Hillary Clinton. She's not running. She's not going to run unless Hillary goes down the tubes. Then you see Elizabeth Warren stepping in because she's an exciting person. She arouses emotions in people, and she knows what she's doing. She knows what she's talking about, especially in the banking field. He noted that women are growing in strength and power in this country. You're going to have a female president. And he said that won't be the end of it. You could have one or two or three right at one after the other because it's the time for the woman in this country. It's inevitable we're going to have the female president. It's inevitable there are going to be more presidents female after the first one. The female gender is doing exceptionally well today in the professional schools, the law and medicine. In some schools, 80 to 85% of the class are women. I didn't even know that. For some reason, the women are excelling and pushing harder, and the men are sitting back. Plus, you have many women today who are running major corporations. And why are women succeeding like this? He says because they're just better equipped to handle problems. This is their time in the sun. This is their day. And they are showing and continue to show that they are physically and mentally equipped to do a job that the men aren't doing anymore. Ted Cruz, he talked about, a loser. Doesn't know where this guy came from. He's a disgrace. He'll never get the Republican nomination. He's a troublemaker. Everything for himself, nothing really for his party. He's not an entrepreneur. He's an exploiter. He's on his way to try to get the nomination. He was not concerned, did not speak well of Cruz. Education concerns him. He feels that our country is failing in the education field, and this is something we all know for the last 20 years. No matter how much money our government throws into education, we're not getting quality graduates out of our high schools. Forget out of our colleges. We're not getting them out of high school. How many kids graduate from high school and don't know how to read or write properly, okay? I can tell you in law schools today, one of the first courses, these are kids who graduated from college, one of the first courses they take in their freshman year is how to write, how to compose a sentence, subject, you know, verb, object. These are things these kids don't know when they're coming out of school anymore. We have to do something about it. Whatever we're doing isn't working. We got to find the right way to make it work. He also made the observation, I forget what this, he says 16% or 16 million children, it's one or the other, go to school every morning hungry. How can children learn if they go to school hungry? Good point. He feels this, and he said this a couple of times, and he felt very strongly. If we do not correct our educational system, because the rest of the world is turning out grads, smart people out of colleges, if we don't correct our educational system, the United States is going to become the biggest banana republic ever, the biggest banana republic ever. Corporate America, simple. He says, I damn corporate America. That's all he said. I damn corporate America. For me, it was an exciting evening. I hope you've enjoyed what I have shared with you tonight that he said last night. The man is brilliant. He's been there. He's retired now. He just sits back and looks and pontificates, but he's still got it going for himself. And it just was a great evening, and I enjoyed his comments. Which now brings me to an issue that's been bothering me lately. I don't know. Sometimes, you know, I go through weeks and I say, what's my topic going to be that I'm going to write on or talk on this week? And one thing that keeps sticking in my craw lately are wars. How many wars our country have been in? The United States has been in how many wars since World War II? All right. And World War II is the biggest war we were ever in. Most people died and everything else. And it doesn't seem to me, I'm speaking for myself, that we have won any war since World War II. Korea, I don't think we were a winner in Korea. Definitely we weren't a winner in Vietnam. We're over in the Middle East for 10 and 12 years in different wars, and we just either say we won and leave, or we just say we're getting out, we've had enough. We're not a winner. We are supposed to be the strongest nation in the world, and we don't seem to exert our strength. We don't seem to fight wars like they should be fought. MacArthur was right in the Korean War when he said, my hands are tied. If I'm going to fight a war, let me fight it. You can't pussyfoot around. You should go in as Eisenhower did on D-Day. You're going to go in, you figure out how many people the enemy has, then you send in 5 or 6 times as many people so you can destroy these people immediately. We don't fight wars like that anymore. We're worried about how many civilians we're going to kill. In the meantime, looking at Vietnam, we lost 60,000 Americans in Vietnam. What a disgrace. Vietnam also was a war. And I remember Vietnam. By the time the thing was concluding, I was about 40 years old. I came out of law school about the time the war was starting. Vietnam. Let's go back to World War II. I want to talk about Vietnam a little bit. I want to talk about the man who was a success there for his country. I also will share with you that I wrote this week's Conk Life column on the man, Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh, and it hits the paper, gets published tomorrow. The article is published in tomorrow's edition of Conk Life, be that as it may. It's World War II. Ho Chi Minh is a military leader of sorts for the Vietnamese people. He's in his country, Vietnam, fighting Japanese. The OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, the CIA of World War II, let me put it that way, they parachuted into Vietnam a group of people, two intelligence people. They were called DEER, D-E-E-R, nicknamed DEER. And they went into Ho Chi Minh's camp. That's where they came initially because he was the man to talk to. Ho Chi Minh was dying. He was very sick. His people couldn't cure him. And the Americans, the OSS people, didn't think they could, but they gave it a shot. They worked on him. They brought medical people in. And lo and behold, he did not die. He survived. Now, he felt very grateful. And he said to the Americans, what can I do for you in return? And they said, look, provide us with intelligence, whatever's happening in Vietnam with the Japanese, and also rescue our downed American pilots. He says, no problem. I'll get you intelligence, and we'll rescue all your downed American pilots, which he did do. He said, though, even though you saved my life, I do want something in return here for what you ask, and this is what I want. I want ammunition, weapons, and military training. Now, we didn't get into a war until 1955 was when the war started that we got involved in Vietnam, and not greatly at that time, but you know, it's the old story, and it's happening in the Middle East now with the Sunnis and the Shia and the Afghans and the Iraqs. We give so many people on different sides ammunition, guns, bullets, airplanes, and we train them. And a year later, they're fighting against us with the stuff we sent them and with the people we train. And so he got his training, and then when the war started, he was using our stuff against us. In 1945... he became the Vietnamese Communist Revolutionary Leader. No question the man was a communist. Always had been a communist. This is what he believed. That's the way it was. Right after World War II, the Vietnamese wanted to be free of France. France, in effect, owned Vietnam. Vietnam was a colony of France. And they didn't want the French taking care of them anymore. They didn't want the French having jurisdiction over them. They wanted to be free. They wanted to have their own government. Ho Chi Minh went to the OSS people, some of the people who had parachuted into his country, and he went to them in Washington or wherever they were. World War II's over. And he says, look, I need help fighting the French. Can't you get your government to help me? Well, they couldn't. But a year later, Ho Chi Minh personally met with President Truman and said, give me a helping hand. And Truman had to explain to him, and Truman was absolutely correct in what he said. How can we help you, give you guns, ammunition, training, and everything else you need, when you're a communist? By this time in the late 1940s, we are in the biggest Cold War. It lasted, 35 years with the Soviet Union, with Russia. He says, we're fighting communism against Russia. They threatened to bomb us. We had to send a nuclear bomb over there in retaliation. It could be the end of the world, and you want us to help you, and you're a communist. He says, I can never make this fly. I could never justify it. So he had to turn Ho Chi Minh down. A wise move by Truman, made sense. Well, now France gets defeated. In 1954, the Vietnamese defeated France with their asses. The French had to leave Vietnam with their tails between their legs. Then we started getting involved about a year later, just with little things. We're going to send maybe 200 guys over to train the non-communist forces and things like that. Things didn't start moving in Vietnam, where we were sending more and more soldiers, to President Kennedy. Kennedy opened the door, and he started sending, 100 here, 200 there, maybe 1,000 here, and he was doing more. He wasn't into it with both feet, but he was doing more. I believe had he not died, he would have done more and more. For some reason, it seemed we had to fight. See, it was a proxy war. Russia was fighting us in Vietnam by backing the North Vietnamese, and we were fighting Russia in Vietnam by backing the non-communist people. That's the way it was in the Cold War. Both countries felt it was better to fight the war in a place like Vietnam rather than destroy our two countries. Be that as it may, now comes Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson, again, I said was a terrific president, except when it came to Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson wanted to be another Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Roosevelt was his hero. Roosevelt led us during World War II, and it was a great victory. Well, he wanted to have that wartime success reputation also. So he started sending, and Vietnam was the place where he was going to do it, because this is where we were going to bring communism to their knees, and he sent more and more troops over. Eventually, I told you, if we lost 60,000 soldiers over there. I don't know how many he sent, but it had to be a hell of a lot more than that. And this is the way it went. Now he starts bombing. Johnson had B-52s going over every day for months, bombing the hell out of the North Vietnamese. And he was telling us, bombing is going to stop these people. We're going to beat them this way. He also wanted big numbers. And what happened, you know the General Westmoreland story. The generals had to give numbers every day of how many Vietnamese were killed the day before. They started making up the numbers for Washington. They were afraid not to go to Washington with big numbers. This was us, folks. This was the United States doing this. And so things went on like that. We left, as the French did. We left Vietnam with our tails between our legs. The war technically was over in 1973. It was still going on in 75. It's late April 1975. The only territory we still control is the embassy in Saigon. That little area is still, we've got a group of Marines there protecting the place. We've got our American personnel. They all came in from all over the countryside, and they're in there. There were walls around it, fences, iron fences. The North Vietnamese are out there yelling, shooting, and screaming for several days. They're going to get in and take over our building. The Marines are keeping them off. We got to get our people out. And we spent 24 hours getting our people out. And how do we do it? A helicopter, one at a time, went to the roof of the embassy and took out American personnel. And the last group they took out, of course, were the Marines. They didn't take care out any of those people that had worked for us, who were Vietnamese, and those people were left to die, and that's what happened to them. But there wasn't time. They got all the Americans out, and once the last Marine was out on the last helicopter, they were finally able to get through those gates, break down the walls, and take over the embassy. I saw this on television. Those of you who are my age saw it on television, too. And you had to feel as, I thought we were disgraced. Here it was, my country, the United States of America, and this little two-bit country, they're forcing us to leave. by the rooftop in a helicopter one at a time from the embassy in Saigon. One of the things they showed at the end also, and it was very dramatic and touching, was a Marine ran over to get the American flag before he left. It was an act of courage. He could have been shot dead. Fortunately, he wasn't. It was a great moment. It was an emotional moment that the man was able to get the flag and run back to the helicopter and jump on with it. But we got knocked out there. We lost the war. Now, let's go back to Ho Chi Minh. He's in this thing. We didn't have to lose this war. He was our friend. We didn't have to have this war. He was our friend. We saved his life in World War II. He wanted help against the French. We turned him down. I don't blame Truman for turning him down. That's the only thing Truman could do. The problem is, though, this man felt abandoned. Ultimately, he became prime minister, president, and the military leader in Vietnam, all at different stages of the war against us. And he did his thing. And he led his people, and he led them to a great victory. They beat the hell out of us, my friends. And that's my story on Ho Chi Minh and Vietnam and how I feel about wars, how we fight our wars today. Which brings me now to Russia. Putin, actually. Putin, boy, it's like this has been his coming out party this past year. He goes to Crimea. He does everything wrong. He lies like an SOB, this guy. And every time you think you got him down, he comes out with an announcement on building another oil line to China. He's got two of them going now. He's got another one going into someplace south of Russia. With Turkey, he's going to let him use a port of theirs, a main port, seaport. He always comes back with something. At the same time that these sanctions that we imposed with several other countries on him are working. The economy of Russia in one year is in shreds. I don't know how this guy does it and comes out with these major announcements. He's even building trains the length of a country. He comes, and he's doing it in conjunction with China, by the way. He comes out with these major announcements, and he gets involved in these things at the same time that their economy's down the tubes. It's in the sewer. But he gets it done because he's got brass testicles. That's the way I look at it. Now, we know we don't want a nuclear war. I have believed since 1991 when the Soviet Union fell, I have believed that the Russians do not want a nuclear war. They have a lot of nuclear weapons as we do. Neither of us wanted a nuclear war. Neither of us threatens each other with a nuclear war. We're not stupid. However, this week, Putin did. He threatened little Denmark with a nuclear warning. He gave him a nuclear warning. Here's what happened. Denmark is part of NATO, and NATO's putting together a missile shield, okay? And what this shield's going to do is if they see the Russians are coming with anything up there that has a nuclear warhead or not, they're going to be able to press buttons and send missiles up there to shoot them down. Well, he says, we're going to send, if you do this, Denmark, and here's what's involved really for Denmark. Denmark is going to give one or two ships, that's all, and on each of those ships, one or two, they're going to set up a type of radar which would allow the ship to be used as a defense shield. In other words, the radar on the ship would be the warning. The missiles wouldn't even come from the ship. They probably are going to come from another country other than Denmark. But he's a thug, Putin, and he says this week to little Denmark, if you do this, he said, we will use nuclear weapons to blow up the ships. Something nobody's done. Nobody's used a nuclear weapon since World War II. This guy, he's got brass testicles. Dangerous man. Which brings me now to a lighter side. Some people just can't win. Some people live under a black cloud. There was a fellow recently in Akron, Ohio, by the name of David Schofield, 50 years old. David was impersonating a police officer, and he pulled over a car he was chasing. He had these big lights on his car, and he pulled this car over and got out and says, hey, I want your license, registration, all this malarkey. And his misfortune was the guy he pulled over was a detective in his own car going home. All right? So, of course, our friend Schofield got arrested. He was charged with impersonating an officer. He also had a lot of guns in the car, and he was charged with mishandling of firearms and also obstructing official business. Interestingly, I thought the guy would have gone to jail for a while. He didn't. He pled guilty. He was fined $1,000, and the guns and ammunition in the car were destroyed. But I find it amusing, though. This guy's lucky. Pull somebody over and happens to be a police officer. Let's see here now. I want to talk a little bit about the death penalty. I won't bore you very long with it, but I think it's important. I have been against the death penalty probably my entire career, and that's because I was a lawyer. And as a lawyer, I know that as good as our jury system is, it does not always work. There are many innocent people in jail. Trust me, my friends, it isn't perfect. I'm not saying it sends 50% or even 75% of the people to jail who shouldn't be there, but it sends a significant number. The problem with the death penalty is if you're going to execute somebody and they shouldn't be there, you've killed an innocent person. And no one should take the life of an innocent person. And you've got to protect that one person. So here's what happens, and this shows you how things fly. Deborah Milke, M-I-L-K-E, Phoenix, Arizona, spent 22 years on death row. 22 years on death row. Fortunately, because of all these appeals people can take that are on death row, she survived 22 years to finally win her case. And there's nothing wrong with that. They say, oh, we got to put them to death right away. Why don't let them have all the appeals? To save the ass of that one or two people who are innocent. That's why you do it. Anyhow, she was charged back when with murdering her four-year-old son. It was a conspiracy thing. She got the services of two men to take her son out into the desert, a four-year-old boy, and shoot him in the head so she could collect insurance proceeds that she had on him. I don't even know how much money could be on a four-year-old. The only proof against her was an alleged confession, an oral confession, not even in writing, that she made to a detective by the name of Armando Saldate, who is now retired. Well, again, she got convicted because he said, this woman admitted to me. There wasn't anybody else around that heard her, but I heard her. She admitted to me that she did this and this. And based on his testimony, this woman was found guilty and sentenced to death. And fortunately, she kept appealing for 22 years, and here's finally what happened. Turns out Armando Saldate has been discredited. This police officer who testified against her did this in numerous other cases, and so many convictions have been overturned because it turns out he was lying. He was boosting himself to the detriment of the person that he was questioning. He said they confessed. They confessed, and now the government in Arizona is finding out the man was a liar, and they didn't. Well, the appellate court, the federal appellate court that finally said, she's free, said no civilized system of justice should have to depend on such flimsy evidence. So the conviction note was overturned. She walked out of court, a free woman. The death penalty's no good, my friends. And this is a perfect example why. And let's see here. We're running out of time. I can't go any farther this week. I enjoy doing the show. I'm glad you listen. Keep joining me every week. Tell your friends to listen in. I think the show is interesting. Many of you listen to the show in its archived version, and I share this with you. It's archived all the time on Black Talk Radio, and it's also archived on YouTube, and also you can find it on my Facebook page for my blog, KeyWestLew.com. My KeyWestLew.com Facebook page. Upper right-hand column, click in the navigation bar where it says Black Talk Radio, and you can listen to my archive show. So I hope whether you join me here or you join me there, that you do join me. I wrote a book, as you know, The World Upside Down. If you like my show, you'll like the book. If you don't like my show, don't buy the book. You will not enjoy it. Thank you again for joining me. I look forward to being with you next week.